Okay, so we're talking about Minhag today. I started researching Minhag, and then I fell down a rabbit hole, and I can't get out. So I've been doing this for a couple of weeks now. This is just going to be scratching the surface, and there's way more on the cutting room floor that didn't get in today. But questions like how Minhag works, or more broadly, how Jewish law, halacha functions, how it operates, how it deals with complicated scenarios, new scenarios, conflicting principles, all of that is really incredibly exciting to me. So I was very excited to be able to share a little piece of that with you guys today. So the core question we're going to try answering, and we'll deal with some side questions as we go, is if a minhag isn't in the Torah, it's not necessarily binding or legal in the way that we think of most other mitzvot, so why are we bound to keeping it? Why are we responsible to follow minhagim that we have or we have inherited, even though they're not part of the Torah that Hashem legislated to us? That's going to be our core question. It's going to get sort of touch on a lot of other halakhic theory or legal theory kinds of pieces that we're going to have to get to as we go. But first, to be a little bit more specific with our topic, we have to figure out what a minhag actually is. And the term is probably more confusing than it is helpful because you have a wide variety of customary practices that you could call minhagim. We'll break them down into a couple of small categories, but there are even more subcategories and different side issues of minhag that we can deal with. Our first is, and we'll look at page number one, minhag is evidence of proper halachic ruling. So this is the first piece that minhag could be useful to us in understanding halacha. It's when minhag tells us what the halacha should be. So in other words, there's a minhag about how to do a certain thing or whether a certain behavior is permitted or prohibited or obligatory. And minhag is just a way of getting at that information. So one really key source where that idea is manifest is this Gemara in Masechet Pesachim. The background of the Gemara is very interesting also. Basically, the Kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash were trying to figure out whether they could offer a Korban Pesach on Shabbos. And they were debating back and forth, and they couldn't figure it out. And eventually they met Hillel, who was a great early Tanaitic figure, the sort of founding father of Beit Hillel. And he told them the answer, and he gave them some argumentation. And at the end, he throws in a little bit of a dig. He says, you guys didn't know the answer because you didn't study properly. Like, you didn't learn from your teachers well. So that's all the back. But eventually, in any case, he gets appointed to be the leader. Apparently, insults don't really bother people, at least when you have the intelligence to back it up. And so he was appointed the Nasi, the authoritative halakhic leader. And following this, very shortly, they had another halakhic question regarding the Korban Pesach and Shabbos. So Hillel determined that any Korban Pesach action does override Shabbos. So for example, on Shabbos, you could shecht the Korban Pesach. Even though normally shechting an animal wouldn't be allowed on Shabbos, the Korban Pesach overrides that rule. So they have a follow-up question on this rule, and they say, Amrulo, Rabbi, our teacher, shechach v'lo hevi sakin me'erev Shabbos mahu. If you forgot to bring a knife to shecht the Korban Pesach, so what do you do? Are you allowed to bring a knife, presumably outside, where you'd be carrying on Shabbos, and that would be problematic as well? Are you allowed to do that preparatory action? Meaning, I understand that the Korban Pesach itself overrides Shabbos, but do preparations for the Korban Pesach override Shabbos or not? And Amar Lehen, now he has to admit his own fault, just what he insulted them for. Amar Lehen, halacha zo shamati vishachachti. I learned this halacha in yeshiva, and then I forgot it. So kind of admitting his own humility there. But what's his solution? Elahanach lehem li Yisrael. Leave Yisrael, leave the Jewish people to sort of figure it out for themselves. Im ein neviim heim, for if they are not prophets, b'nei neviim heim, they are still the children of prophets. Sort of an enigmatic line. What do you think Hillel's trying to get at here with this, I guess, solution or approach?
Well, prophets tend to kind of get what they need to do. Like, get the information of what they need directly from Hashem. So saying, they're not prophets. They can't just, like, get the information directly from Hashem. But they're children of prophets. They're descendants of people who could. And therefore, even if they don't, like, actively get something from Hashem, whatever they end up doing, maybe it's from Hashem because they're descended from prophets.
They can figure it out, too.
All right, so we have two sort of potential sources of knowledge that you guys are talking about. Maybe they have some kind of quasi-prophetic knowledge, like a Ruach HaKodesh, or something, spiritually imbuing them with the information. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're just We should trust the members of the community to be wise enough to figure it out. Those are two potential ways of explaining what's going on here. But the shared basis of your explanations is that we should trust B'nai Israel to get it right. They're not going to make a mistake about this for either spiritual or intellectual reasons. And, lo, that is what seems to happen. Lemachar, that chet is the typo, Misha Pischo Tala, Tochavo B'tzamro. Misha Pischo Gedi, Tochavo Ben Karnav. So what would they do? They would bring their Korban Pesach, their sheep, to the Beit HaMikdash, and anyone who brought a lamb would stick the knife into the wool of the lamb, so they wouldn't be carrying it themselves. Their animal would be carrying it up to the Mikdash. Sounds?
That's risky.
Well, they're going to be putting the knife into the sheep a little bit later anyway. They're just doing an early version of it.
Give it a, what's it called?
A mum. That's true. Presumably the idea is that the lamb would have thick enough wool that you kind of get it in there.
Maybe
the
knife was in a sheath and you're just putting the knife at the sheath into the wool. Like, carrying
it. Also possible. Intuitively, it feels like in order to get into like the thick wool, you would need it to not be in a sheath. But also, I don't know anything about this. So, no, like, this is a shame, because I always do these, like, interesting, like, reality-based or scientific-based topics, and I just don't know enough background, so. But I try to do my research, so if anyone has any good pictures of really fluffy sheep, that would definitely help for next time. So anyway, they would do that. If you were going to bring a goat instead of a lamb, so you would stick the knife sort of between its horns, maybe, you know, sort of jam it in there so it doesn't fall out. And either way, they'd be able to carry it. And Ra'am Ma'asav, Hillel saw them do this, V'nizkar halacha, and he remembered what the halacha was, and he said, Kach mikublani mipi Shmaya v'Avtalion. This is what I received from my teacher, Shmaya and Avtalion. These are, if you learn the first chapter of Pirkei Avot, you see a lot of these names, because these are some of the early, very early Tanaim. So, here's one example where you look at what the people are doing, and what the people are doing ends up being the correct halachic practice. So, here, minhag is evidence for what mitzvah to do. Now, this isn't the kind of minhag we're talking about today, right? This is the kind of minhag that is really relevant to law. It's just, I could learn law from a book, or I could learn law from what people do. And here, there's a second source of legal or halakhic information that isn't minhag. The second example is pretty similar. It's a little bit different. Here, we have minhag that is based on a halakhic ruling. So there are a couple of minority opinions that this Gemara in source number 2 in Mesachet Shabbat indicates are practiced by people who either live in the same locale as the author of this minority shita, or submit to his authority. So here are their examples. Tanu Rabbanan. V'imkomo shavar b'Eliezer hayu korten eitzim la'asot pechamim la'asot barzel b'Shabbos. They would cut wood in order to make coals, in order to smelt iron on Shabbos. And in the context of the Gemara, it's clear that they're doing it in order to make a knife, in order to do a bris milah.
There's got to be a better way to do that.
Right, so there's got to have been a better way to do that. You know, the idea that you have to do these, three or four preparatory steps is sort of incredulous. I'm a little bit skeptical of it, sort of as a historical thing that it would have happened very often, right? You don't have a knife anywhere. You have to cut down the trees to make the coals. But the legal position is clear. Similar to Hillel's point in the earlier Gemara, the idea here is that Rabbi Eliezer believes that any preparation to do a bris milah overrides Shabbos. So, if a baby is born on a Saturday, so his bris will be on his 8th day, which will also be another Saturday, and we will do a bris on Shabbos. That's the opinion that is now mainstream. But we wouldn't do any of these preparatory actions. So if you couldn't find a knife or any kind of sharp object that would be valid for a bris milah, you wouldn't be able to do that bris on Shabbos. You'd have to wait till the next day in order to buy or fashion a knife. If you lacked one. But Rabbi Eliezer thought that you could do these preparations, and this is very important, bimkomo shel Rabbi Eliezer, in his region, the region dominated by his rabbinic influence, they would actually practice that. So their minhag, so to speak, their practice behavior was to follow a minority or fringe halachic view. Another one, and this is maybe a slightly more well-known example, bimkomo shel Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, what would they do? They would eat chicken and milk. Right? We, in the majority opinion, assume that even chicken and milk is a problem. It's not only, mammalian meat and milk that is a problem, but even fowl as well. But Rabbi Yossi HaGalili apparently did not think so, and so he would allow you to have a chicken burger with cheese. And in his region, they would do that. So these are two examples that the Gemara assumes, and doesn't seem to challenge this premise, that in a geographic region where you have a minority authority, you can rely on that authority and follow your minhag in that way. So example number one, example number two, these minhag as evidence of a halachic ruling or minhag as being based on a halachic ruling are both kinds of minhag that are themselves very interesting to delve into. I'm especially interested in the second question, which we're not going to get to tonight, but it sort of raises the broader question of how do I decide which rabbinic authorities I follow? And once I've chosen a rabbinic authority, do I follow them in everything? Do I have the right to choose in different areas? Really interesting questions that we're putting to the side for a second. But those are two kinds of minhag that we could be talking about, but we're not. The third kind of minhag is what we are dealing with. Minhagim that go beyond the law. And a classic example of this comes in the beginning of this, I think the fifth parak of Masechet Pesachim, Makom Shenahagu. And this Mishnah is a sort of a, this Mishnah and then this parak are really our classical areas that deal with the authority of Minhagim. So here's one major source that you should know about this. Makom Shenahagu la'asot malacha va'arbei Pesachim ad chatzot. In places that have the Minhag to allow you to do malacha on Erev Pesach until chatzot, meaning until midday, after which it's important to not do malacha unless you're preparing for Pesach and getting ready for the Seder and so on. But some places, and some places have no minhag to go earlier than that, meaning until 6 hours in the day, you could do whatever you want. You could go to work, work half a day, come home, prepare for Pesach. So you could do that. But makom shenahagu shelo la'asot enosin. But if you live in a place that has a contrary practice, namely that you can't do work even earlier in the day, the Mishnah says you're not allowed to do work there. So, okay, geographical location A and geographical location B. What about people who travel from one to the other? Haholech mimakom she'osim lemakom she'enosin. O mimakom she'enosin lemakom she'osin. Notnin alav chumre makom she'yatza misham v'chumre makom she'halach l'sham. If you're traveling from point A to point B or from point B to point A, so you're not really dwelling in either region, so the halacha seems to be that you're obligated to the more stringent opinions of both regions. What we'll find later on in the analysis there is that once you've moved, if I've moved from city A to city B, and now I live here permanently, I now reject the old minhagim I had and adopt the new ones. So it seems interesting that the emphasis of minhag is on geography. We're focusing on makomot. Different places have different minhagim. And the implication here seems to be that minhagim are binding, right? When I live in a certain city, I'm bound to that practice. Which I think is interesting. Someone once asked me when I just started here in the Kollel, do I think that the CRC is binding for Chicago residents? And I wasn't sure, because you could make an argument that they're sort of asserting the authoritative position of Chicago, and if I live in Chicago, I'm bound to their rulings for at least matters of kashrus, maybe generally. You could probably push back on that a little bit, and it becomes much more complicated once you integrate things like being Ashkenazi versus being Sephardi. Right, and if you have different, you know, ethnic minhagim, maybe that complicates the picture. But we have to leave that to the side for now. And the last line we'll see in this Mishnah is, I think, interesting and starts us on our next question. Ve'al yishana adam mipnei ha-machloket. A person should not deviate, should not be different, to avoid disputes. So maybe we're starting to get a little bit at one argument in favor of following your local minhag, which is being divergent from the community creates disputes and tension in the community, and that is detrimental, at least to a community. Maybe it's even prohibited. I want to avoid that, so we maintain a certain kind of conformity by all preserving a certain unified minhag. Yeah.
How does something like minhag on a phone work? If you have, say, more than one rub that people pass by within a community, if they have like different opinions.
So, a fascinating question, and definitely one of the rabbit holes I fell down. This becomes really relevant in America. We're not used to it, but a lot of the early literature, all of early halakhic literature, really, assumes that in city X, you have certain leading authorities, and in city Y, you have different ones. And you have some cities with multiple authorities, but generally, there's an idea that, like, Minhag Spain is this, Minhag France is that. In America, everyone just moved here, and there was no established authoritative community, and everything got mixed up, especially in bigger cities. The short answer seems to be that the idea of authoritative geographic minhagim breaks down a little bit when my living here doesn't imply my allegiance to any particular authority. Right. That seems to be the approach.
People, like, in this country, don't seem to go by geographic
minhagim. Right. There are a couple of interesting ways this has diverged in history. So the first is that we've moved partially away from, you know, real geography, like where I currently live, to historical geography, right, where my ancestors lived. That's why you have Ashkenazim and Sephardim, and then Sephardim also break down into a dozen different identities, whether you're from Persia or Morocco, or I mean, Ashkenazim too, to a lesser extent. You know, a Hungarian isn't the same as a German. So that's one way it shifted. And another way it shifted, which is, I think, even more interesting, but I don't have more to say about it right now, is that we've shifted a little bit to ideological communities as opposed to geographic ones. So if I identify, let's say, as a modern Orthodox person, I might ask my modern Orthodox rabbinic authorities what to do and be, maybe be bound by that communal norm as opposed to a communal norm defined by spatial geography. Both of those are really interesting developments. The development to, yeah. And then things that weirder in Israel, where there's a pressure to maintain minhagim and a pressure to synthesize, right? We want the Jewish people in Israel, maybe, to be doing the same thing. So a lot of interesting side questions that I would love to do more of these topics if people are interested, and we'll talk about more topics later on. Okay, so that was all for by way of introduction to the idea of minhag, and specifically the idea of extra-legal minhag, meaning the idea of not doing work on Erev Pesach before midday. Nobody thinks that it's legislated. Nobody thinks that it's an authoritative law of biblical or rabbinic authority. Everyone agrees it's purely customary. But nonetheless, customary practice seems to be binding. And so the question is why? And we might present a couple of different theories or models depending on exactly the kind of minhag we might be talking about. So, for example, we may talk about a personal minhag, right? If I personally have adopted a, you know, religious practice, am I bound to continue doing it after I've started doing it, after I've, you know, set my mind to doing it, maybe? And the Gemara in Nedarim deals with this. Anyone who's doing Daf Yomi these days has seen this relatively recently. It quotes a breita. Va'atanya, and it's Tanya breita. Usually that word is actually begins the question in Gemara. It's a bit odd. Nedarim seems to have a slightly different language than other parts of Gemara. Here, we're not using this as a question. We're just asserting this. Dvarim hamutarim, things that are permitted. Va'acherim nahagu bahem iser, but some people have practiced prohibition regarding those things, meaning even though I know it's allowed, I have a personal stringency not to do this. So what should you do? Iyatar rashai latiram bifneam. You're not allowed to permit those things to them. Shene amar lo yachel dvaro. As the pasuk says, he shall not profane, I suppose, is a good translation here, his words. That's a pasuk in the Torah that has to do with making a neder, making an oath. So just like halacha recognizes that when I make an oath that I swear that I'm going to bli neder, but put that in parentheses, that I'm going to you know, be here every week for the next several years, I can make that oath and that would be binding, right? It's possible to make a binding personal obligation autonomously, and if you do that, then in order to, you know, not violate that neder, you either have to do what you said you would do. There are processes for being matur nedarim. You could go before a beit din and have them annul it. But broadly speaking, we recognize the idea that a person is able to make a personal obligation upon themselves that other people aren't bound by, but I am bound by. And what the Gemara in Nedarim seems to be suggesting is that a minhag works the same way. Even if I don't articulate it verbally, which is what is necessary for the biblical obligation of a neder to fall on you, in order to be obligated, you know, midin Torah, you have to articulate it. But even if I just decide to adopt a certain practice, I would be bound by that decision. Almost all, authorities assume that it's a rabbinic obligation, but nonetheless. So model number one to think about minhag is as personal binding obligation. I've accepted this practice upon myself, and I'm going to stick with it. Why will this not go far enough for us in justifying adhering to minhag more broadly? Right? This is going to be a little bit lacking.
You can make a personal oath to keep it.
Right, so depending on the minhag, right, some minhagim at least, I never said in my mind, I'm always going to do this, right? Let's choose one example that comes up. Most of you, at some point when you were kids, were told, this is how long we wait between meat and milk. You probably didn't say, I think this is the right amount of time to wait, and I will commit myself to doing so. Certainly not early on. Certainly early on, you just thought this is what you had to do. And yet, we would assume, by default, that this kind of minhag maybe should be considered binding, and you should really be stuck to a certain length of time that you might want to wait. That might not be a great example Some authorities seem to dispute exactly how rigidly halachic that rule is, but that seems to be a great example of minhag being something that is imposed upon you from without. Which leads us to our second model. Our second model is the model of a legislated minhag. So we're sort of going back to an earlier kind of category, but the idea of certain things are binding upon me because they've been legislated, either by God, by the rabbis, or maybe just by a legislated popular practice. The Rambam maybe adopts this viewpoint. He describes how, well, this is the beginning of Hilchot Mamrim, right? This is the section of the Rambam's magnum opus, right? He has a comprehensive work on all of Torah called the Mishnah Torah. And in this section, in Mamrim, he deals with authority structures. So he deals with the authority that your parents might have over you, the authority that rabbinic authorities might have over you. And so he starts by, this is the very beginning, by outlining the sort of prototypical example of rabbinic authority, which is the Sanhedrin HaGadol, the 71-member court in Yerushalayim that would have really complete authority in how the Torah is interpreted. Beit Din HaGadol Shel Yerushalayim, Hem Ikar Torah Shebaal Peh. They are the foundation of the oral Torah, the oral tradition. Vim Amud HaHorah, and they are the pillar of legal rulings. Umehem Choku Mishpat Yotzei L'chol Yisrael, and from them laws are promulgated out to the entire nation. V'aleihem Hivticha Torah, and regarding them, the Torah guarantees Shena'amar, what should you do? Al Pia Torah Asher Yerucha V'al Mishpat Asher Yomru Lecha Ta'aseh. All of the ruling that they teach you, you should do. And he says this is a mitzvah ta'aseh and a mitzvah lo ta'aseh. It's a positive and negative commandment. Listen to them, don't not listen to them. So double the commandment, double the severity. Jumping ahead to the third paragraph now. So what kinds of things are they licensed to do? What kind of authority do they possess? Echad dvarim shalamdu otam mipi hashmua. If they have a received tradition of what to do or how to practice Judaism, you're bound to that. Vim torah shebaal peh. Ve'echad dvarim shalamdu otam mipi da'atam b'acham min amidot shatorah nidreshet b'hem. And if it's not a received tradition, but by their own analysis of the text of the Torah, they discern a certain binding interpretation, you're bound to that as well. V'nira b'enayim sh'adin b'davar zeh kachu, in the following way. And ve'echad dvarim sh'asu otan siyag la'Torah, u'lefi ma'asha esha tzricha. And if they make an extra legal, meaning extra Torah, right? Not in the Torah, but they just impose an independent obligation as a fence to the Torah, meaning to protect from Torah violations, we impose additional rabbinic restrictions to avoid those violations. V'heim, and what are the three categories here? Hagzerot, hatakanot, Vamin Hagot. So Agzera seems to be a rule that exists to distance you from a prohibition, right? So I don't carry in a Carmelite on Shabbos, right? A non very public area, because I might come to carry in a Rosh Hashanah, which is a very public area, and that would be a biblical violation. A takana is an independent rabbinic obligation. Let's say lighting Shabbos candles, right? The rabbis just instituted that as a rule. Hanukkah candles may be a bit more timely. And a minhag, which is a popular practice. But these can apparently be legislated, meaning the authoritative centralized body of Judaism, the Sanhedrin, seems to have the power to legislate minhagim, meaning legislate how things should be practiced. Now, I'm not sure exactly what minhagim he's referring to. He could be referring to minhagim like we've talked about before. I'm not exactly sure. He doesn't describe that category in greater detail. But it seems at least that there would be a centralized authority to make these kinds of rules. I assume what he means, I'm not certain, is that he's not talking about independent obligations, but rather, ways of performing mitzvot. So to pick another example of minhag, nusach ha-tfilah, right? So in any shul you'll go to, by definition, they have to daven in a certain way, right? They can't daven in no manner whatsoever. So you'll go to a shul that happens Nusach Ashkenaz, or Nusach Sfard, or Nusach Yedot HaMizrach, or others, you know, the Italians have their own Nusach, Provençal, Frenchmen have their own Nusach, you have different options like that. Also different tunes that you might use, right? You have to daven in some musicality, that could be no tune, but that's a choice, right? However you're doing it, you're choosing how to do it. So that might be what he means by minhag, but I'm not exactly sure. Okay, so this is the second category, the idea of a minhag as something that is sort of legislated from the top down, and becomes binding in that way. The same way that rabbinic obligations are binding, so too the manner of performance in mitzvot. I mean, minhagim might be binding in a similar kind of fashion. Sources 6 and 7, I think, might be alluding to the same thing. In the interest of time, we're going to skip over them. But maybe the earliest sources that explicitly say, here's why you should follow a minhag, might be this source in source number 7. Very quickly, the pasuk says, lo tasi gvul re'echa, don't sort of circumvent the boundary of your fellow, asher gavlu rishonim v'nachalatcha, that the early ones in older days have established in your land. So don't avoid that that fence. Don't avoid that boundary. Don't breach that boundary, maybe. So that leads Rav Shira Gaon, who's a fairly early pre-Rishonic authorities Gaon, says, Mikan de minhagam el tehu. This is how I know that minhag is a thing, right? Don't breach the aforementioned established boundaries means don't breach the rules that were established by earlier authorities as well. Maybe the earliest source, and I think it might be getting to a similar kind of idea that the Rambam is getting to. Early authorities established these rules, I'm bound to their establishment of them, consciously, intentionally. So that's the second kind of minhag that we could ground in a certain kind of authority, but we still haven't answered our main question, which is, okay, what about minhagim that don't seem to be legislated, right? No centralized authority made us do it, and minhagim that I didn't freely choose for myself. What authority does my community have to impose a minhag's obligation upon me? And that leads us to sources number 8, 9, and so on. So here's the Gemara in Pesachim. It continues from the earlier source about minhag that we saw about the locations of a minhag. B'nei Baishan, nahug delohavu azlin mitzor letzidon v'ma'ale shabta. The B'nei Baishan, and I left that deliberately untranslated because it's a bit tricky to figure out exactly what it means, had a practice not to travel from Tzor to Tzidon on Erev Shabbos in order to do their business or go about their needs. And that so seems to be at least a fairly long-standing practice in these communities. Atu benayu kamed Rabbi Yochanan. They went to Rabbi Yochanan and they said, Amrulo, ava hatin efshar lehu, anan lo efshar lan. Our ancestors were able to follow this rule, seemingly economically, meaning seemingly they'd be able to work, you know, Sunday to Thursday, and not go traveling to do work on Friday, and still be able to make a decent living. But we are having a much more difficult time, economically speaking. We're no longer able to maintain this practice. So are we allowed to deviate from this sort of communal practice? Happens to be interesting that they knew this was a communal practice, they knew it wasn't legal, and they still felt the need to ask. So at least they were assuming that minhag should, by default, be a fairly authoritative kind of thing. What's Rabbi Yochanan's answer? Amar lehu, kvar kiblu avotechem aleihem. Your ancestors already accepted it upon themselves, and the implication seems to be, once they've accepted it upon themselves, you can't deviate from it. And he quotes a pasuk from the beginning of Sefer Mishlei. Shene amar, shema b'ni musar avicha, hear my son, the rebuke of your father, evalti tosh torah imecha, and do not abandon the Torah of your mother. And the Torah here is also a pretty strong term, but I think it refers to laws, right? Anything that was legally accepted by your ancestors is something that you are bound by. He hasn't really articulated a legal mechanism for why that should be the case, but at least he's grounded it in a source in Tanakh, which is a good thing. The more you can ground it in a text of Torah or Tanakh, the happier you are. There's a little bit of an implication, I think, in that word Torah that maybe that hints a little bit to a potential answer to our problem, right? Connecting communal practice to Torah might be interesting. Before we go on to the next source, I just want to make the observation about B'nai Baishan. So I left it untranslated, right? It could refer to one of two things. So B'nai Baishan could mean the residents of this place called Baishan, which is probably short for Beit Sha'an, which is a city that exists in modern Israel and existed in the time of the Gemara as well. The same way you have, you know, B'nai Yisrael, who are not directly necessarily children of Yaakov, but are members of the nation. So you could use the term B'nai to mean that. Or you could use the term B'nai to refer to literal sons. Baishan might be a guy's name, and his children were asking him about the personal practice of their, you know, parents. The major question that really depends on this is, how much does your family have authority to establish a minhag? Right? It's one thing to say that the city of Chicago or the region of Spain or Italy is able to establish a minhag. It's very different to say that what your parents do is binding for you, and what you do will be binding to your families and children and descendants. So that is a very important debate that exists. Generally, it seems like more authorities view it as communal, meaning more of them assume it refers to residents of a city than it does to descendants of an individual. But both views are attested, and generally the idea that familial minhag is binding is seems to be accepted, maybe a little bit less than communal minhag.
Are you implying that some people think familial minhag is not binding for the children?
Yes, there are some achronim who thought that.
I think
the general communal practice, and you know, if anyone has experiences to support or deny this, I'm happy to hear. I think the general assumption is that familial minhag is something that should be followed, but maybe with less authority than what we might consider communal minhag. So whatever communal minhag means nowadays, right, if it means anything in Chicago, maybe being Ashkenazi has more authority than my personal parents' practice. But there seems to be a sense that it exists but is a little bit less serious and therefore a little bit easier to override. Just to give one example of how it seems that there might not be such a minhag, at least from the Gemara, I think it's Mar Ukva is one of the Amoraim. So we'll go back to our earlier example of waiting between meat and milk. So Mar Ukva says in the Gemara, I consider myself to be vinegar, the son of wine, meaning I am not as righteous as my father. What would my father do? He would wait a full day between meat and dairy. I only wait between meals. So if family minhag is binding, so why wouldn't he have waited just like his father waited? So that's one of the proofs that people bring to say that familial minhag isn't necessarily binding. You could also maybe distinguish and say personal stringencies might not be binding, but you know, family practice might be binding in, you know, more generally. You could make different distinctions that way.
Give an example, like, something that would apply today.
Of a family minhag that would not necessarily be binding?
Yeah, but like something that actually happens today, because no one waits between milk and meat an entire day nowadays. So like something that would actually happen today.
So here's one example, and that might fall under the personal stringency kind of thing that you might... That might be an important distinction to make that we could try exploring in another context. But there are people who don't rely on Erevin, right? They personally will not carry in a city with an Erev. Mm-hmm. But that won't be a thing that will be imposed on the family, right? It won't necessarily be that I don't follow the Erev, therefore my children don't have to follow the Erev. It could be a personal stringency that I've adopted while knowing that my children, my siblings, my wife don't necessarily have to adopt those same practices.
But isn't that only true when people take it on as a chumrah and not as an interpretation of halakha? Like, riskers don't hold to the Erevim because they feel that they're not kosher and they feel that it's actually Rosh Hasharabim. So their families still can't hold to the Erev because it's Rosh Hasharabim and they feel like it's usher to carry there.
Right, so I was trying to give an example of a familial minhag that maybe wouldn't have that same authority. I think, like I said before, generally...
I'm saying, does it only apply when they take it on as a chumrah and not
as opposed to
their interpretation of halakha?
It's an interesting question.
I see
the distinction. I think the distinction is very compelling.
The same concept with briskers and yashan, and like also chassidim and pesach and how they peel everything. They feel that halachically you have to.
Gebrachts maybe would be an interesting example, though it depends there also. Is that a stringency or is that a...
Right, so that's the question. Because some people do these things as chumrah, right. And some people do them as that is halacha, you cannot deviate.
I think it would be pretty tricky to find an authority going on the books as saying you could choose to not follow a family practice without a counter-pressure, right? So I can imagine a counter-pressure being, I saw this in one case, I don't remember where, a person whose father was himself ethnically Sephardi, but not from. He was raised in Ashkenazi schools and yeshivas and adopted personal Ashkenazi practices. And then his father eventually became a Baal Tshuva and adopted Sephardi practices and wanted his son to follow Sephardi practices also. So those are legal rulings, right? Ashkenazim and Sephardim have legal differences. But that would be a case where there's counter-pressure, right? In order for me to adopt my father's minhag, I have to abandon my education. And that's a very hard push. So, like I said, I think the general rule would be, it would be hard to find someone who would just tell you, totally ignore your family legal practice. But when there are counter pressures, it's easier to override my family does this than it is to override my community does this, or all Ashkenazim do this. I think that seems to be the general approach that Poskim will take. Okay, let's see if we can try grounding one or two ideas of legal theory further, try to explain this Gemara and Pesachim, right? Why was the community of Beit She'an, of Baishan, bound to their family practice? So one fascinating articulation of this comes in a tshuva of the Rivash. He's quoting the Ramban. So big names. Certainly the Ramban is a big name in this regard. He's dealing with a really fascinating case. Sometimes reading the cases of these responses is almost more interesting than reading the answers. He had a community that wrote to him and said that they wanted to establish a rule that no one could get married without it being approved by the central leaders of the community. And any attempt to get married without their knowledge and consent would be considered null and void. That's a kind of fascinating communal institution. It would solve a lot of those summer camp stories that you hear, where like one camper gave the other a bottle cap and said, "Hare Mikudeshitli," and then you have to figure out how to avoid them being married. It raises, you know, it might have avoided a lot of problems if this was a widespread practice, which it is not. So, and the Rivash was asked, okay, can we as a locale establish this practice, even on people who might come to move here again in the future? Meaning, even if we, the current residents of whatever city it was, I'm going to make it up, it probably was not Hamburg, but it's going to be Hamburg for now. If the residents of Hamburg didn't, even if we all agreed to it, maybe new members of the city don't agree to it. So are we allowed to impose this as a local obligation that would be binding on future generations and on new imports? And he says, Yecholim, they can. Yecholim b'nei ha'ir la'asot b'neihem, takanot ubdarim v'haskamot, v'liknos ha'overalayim midin Torah. They're allowed to make all these different kinds of rules and to penalize anyone who violates those rules. So it's a one step even further than making the rule binding. They're even able to penalize. The penalty here is technical, meaning in order to avoid them being married, the penalty is that the item that was used to facilitate the Kedushin, right? Nowadays we use a ring, but you could really use anything. That item is sort of removed from the property of the owner retroactively, so his act of Kedushin was retroactively not valid, right? Now that I know you got married illicitly, it was as though the ring that you gave wasn't really yours in the first place. So that's the sort of penalty. We're removing that from your property. That's a side point. And then he gives a broader legal theory to justify how communities have authority at all. The Chatav HaRambanza B'Mishpat HaCherem. What's the idea? Shekein HaDin B'Chol Kabbalat HaRabim. Any communal acceptance has the same ruling. Shechala Aleihem V'Alzaram. It applies to them and their children. And why? Kida'ashkechan b'kabbalat ha-Torah v'chin b'megillah o b'tzavot. It's a fascinating paradigm that Ramban uses. He says, why are communal acceptances practice, are authoritative? Well, why am I bound to the Torah at all? The only reason I'm bound to the Torah is that as a nation, we accepted it. And national acceptances are binding on the nation. And as a member of that nation, I have the privileges of the nation and the obligations of that nation. That itself, you know, we could talk about why the Torah is binding, but that assumption, yes, that the Torah is binding because we agreed to it, seems to be found in the Gemara and Shabbos as well, also explains why a group or a community has the authority to agree to a communal practice that will be binding on future generations as well. She'afilu bidvarim shelo kiblu aleihem b'nei ha'ir b'haskama. Even things that were not officially agreed upon, meaning the town council didn't vote on it, there was no referendum that in which we all agreed to it, but rather, Elah Shenahagu came me'atzmam, they just practiced it, they happened to come to this practice. La'asot geder v'syag la'Torah, to protect the Torah with these additional protections. Af abanim chayavim linhog ba'oto geder. The descendants are still bound to that same ruling, that same fence. So Ramban's theory is, unlike a legislative minhag, which is the authority of legislation, right, within the halachic system you're allowed to legislate, and unlike a personal practice, which is binding as a neder or a rabbinic level neder, that also is something I've been empowered to do by the Torah, communal minhag works a little bit differently. It's not part of the Torah system we've already adopted. It's an addition to the Torah system we've already adopted. So I've adopted biblical law and rabbinic law and all the consequences thereof. And now, onto that whole structure, I attach a little box called I am a member of this community, and they also can make laws. And communal acceptance of those laws works the same way communal acceptance of the Torah does. So a fascinating kind of perspective that almost grants Menhagim quasi-Torah status, right? They're binding on me the same way anything is binding on me. Because I, as a member of a nation, I've accepted it. Now, this is a kind of idea that's very tricky for modern people. I'm a modern person also. It's not not an insult. But it's tricky because individualism is a very... It's not even like a popular idea. It's like a background idea. You kind of take it for granted that I make decisions for myself and my singular personal identity is primary or exclusive in how I choose to do things. But I make decisions. I choose how I want to live my life. I think classically, at least in classical Jewish texts, the individual identity seems to be at least paired with a thing called a communal identity. As a member of a tzibor, as a member of a nation, I have obligations and privileges contingent on me being a part of that nation and me being part of that community, which I think, you know, works. There's no reason a priori that I should deny that communities have authority to legislate or to impose obligation. But this thing is a little bit foreign to many sort of modern listeners. I was trying to find answers that were a little bit more individualistic. I struggled because the idea that communities have authority presumes that the community is a unit that you can evaluate and judge and discuss. If anyone's ever read Rabbi Jonathan Sacks's A Letter in the Scroll, I think it's the best... I've only read a little bit of it so far, but I think it's the best attempt at trying to ground these things in personal choice. Like, why do I opt into being a part of this community? It's a very nice book. And happy to spend time with it another time. The last perspective I'll summarize outside in the interest of time. I also know that we'll almost certainly be asked to join a Maariv minyan, so if anyone's able to stay, now's the time to start planning for that. But the last perspective is claimed to be the view of the Rambam, and is definitely the view of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the father of Rav Soloveitchik in New York, also the Rav Soloveitchik in Chicago, who argues that the reason communal minhag is binding is something we alluded to already. Right? We go back to the Mishnah, source number, 4, I think it was. Source number 3. The last line of that Mishnah was, Al yishana adam im neham achloka. Don't deviate from communal practice to avoid disputes. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik is kind of arguing a parallel argument. He says, you must follow communal practice because there's a religious value. It's not a formal, mitzvah or prohibition in the Torah, but there's a religious value of not being poreish min hatzibur, deviating from the community's practice. And so this seems to offer a sort of overarching justification for any kind of communal norm, including ones that aren't formalized in any kind of way. But there's a religious value of being a member of the community. And so if the community happens to do it, it's not binding on me in the sense that I also have this independent obligation, but it is binding on me in as much as I'm supposed to do things like the way people around me are doing them. And if I deviate from those practices, I'm separating myself from the community. And that can be a very serious religious problem of being an isolated religious individual as opposed to a member of a community. The Rambam in particular emphasizes this theme. It sounds like if you're a perfect religious person, you just don't live in a community with other religious people, you're seriously lacking in your Judaism because you're not a member of a community that's also engaged in that relationship with God or the relationship with Torah that it presumes. That might be another... I don't want to call it a side argument because it solves all of our problems very nicely, but another sort of angle on why communal practice may be considered binding on us. So just to recap quickly, because it was a lot of different ideas and perspectives here, right? So why would we consider a minhag binding? We have a couple of answers depending on the kind of minhag, right? One perspective we saw is that it may be binding like a neder is binding. I'm allowed to accept an obligation upon myself, and those obligations are taken seriously, and the Torah expects you to fulfill those obligations, just like a regular neder, and even without articulating it, it still has the status and the authority of a neder. We might talk about minhagim as being legislated, the same way rabbinic laws are legislated. Also, a minhag could be legislated. A manner of performing a mitzvah could be equally binding rabbinically. And then we have our final, I think, two approaches that really address the communal issue, the position of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik we just mentioned, the idea that my deviation from the tzibur, from the community's practice, is itself religiously problematic. Doesn't matter what the communal's practice was or how they got there, just the fact that I deviated is bad. And the Ramban's view that the way that any community is ever bound by law is by accepting it as a community. And just like we accepted the Torah and we accepted the Megillah, he also mentions as another example, we've also accepted the communal practices of our local community as well. I want to end with just one slightly more philosophical note that helps contextualize minhag in our religious lives. So this is really an interesting line, and it gets quoted a lot. It's a very powerful line in Tosfot, source number 11, and it's really just an excerpt. There's a whole discussion surrounding it. Uminhag avotenu torahi. Then our ancestors minhagim are Torah. We saw that line earlier. Al titosh torat imecha. The Torah of your mother is something that you are bound by. I think contextualizing minhag in Torah becomes really important because I think there are two almost competing or maybe paradoxically complementary dynamics in minhag. One element of minhag is very conservative, lowercase c, right? The idea is it tries to preserve the status quo. So when I follow the minhag, I'm trying to be exactly like my grandparents were when they did their Judaism, who were trying to be like their grandparents were when they did their Judaism. In more academic Torah circles, you'll hear that called the mimetic tradition, right? The tradition is passed down and is mimicked from parent to child, and the goal is to be as close to earlier generations as possible. Rav Chaim Palachi, in source number 12, articulates this very nicely. He says, don't deviate from any minhag, because what will happen? De'im yavo, I'll start from the end of the first line, de'im yavo lismo kol echad, the translation, by the way, is on page 5, if everyone makes their own decision that isn't bound by conventional communal practice or historical communal practice, then what will happen? We would completely break any sense of historical Jewish continuity, the idea that my Judaism has any relationship with the Judaism of people 100 years ago. And the goal of preserving Minhagim is to preserve that connection, to feel like the Torah I have now is the Torah that Rav Soloveitchik had, which is the Torah that Ramban had, which is the Torah that the Gemara had. And it's all part of the same shared religious experience. And changing that is too fast breaks those connections, and we lose a feeling of being part of a thousand-year-old national tradition. So part of it is very conservative. But the other part, I think, is almost radically empowering, right? It allows for a lot more change. Progressive is the wrong word because it presumes it's a destination, but just it's maybe liberal is the right word. I'm not sure. It's open to a lot of change. And that's articulated very nicely. It's an old essay already, but it's an essay in tradition in 1965. The source of minhag, properly viewed and understood, is itself divine. We already saw that idea that sometimes the Jewish people are prophets. They have a sort of quasi-divine understanding of their of how they should live their religious lives. While direct prophecy operated only in individual personalities, there's no such thing as a prophecy that is shared by large groups of people. But the teachings of the sages are to be considered as a prophetic divine revelation, manifesting itself within the collective body of the Sanhedrin. We saw Rambam mentioned that the Sanhedrin are the most authoritative minhag establishers. But similarly, the totality of Israel is viewed by tradition as an abode of the Shekhinah. Even just the Jewish people as a people are B'nai Nevi'im. They have that divine element. The minhagim are the expression of the sublime spirituality of Israel. Thus, proper religious customs reflect the enduring vitality and eternal freshness of the religious impulse, the unbroken creativity of our people, and its continued prophetic strength. In other words, what I think Dr. Kalir is arguing here, minhag is our way of very actively contributing to the Torah. There was Torah, God revealed a certain thing at Har Sinai, then the rabbis of the Gemara added to it, or interpreted it. And when a minhag develops 800 years ago in medieval Germany, that was a sort of prophetic moment that was added to the Torah. This minhag is now part of the corpus of Torah. And the same thing is true when a minhag was established 500 years ago and 300 years ago and today. Now, it's a bit hard to see contemporarily because it's hard to see what is going to be a minhag that lasts and what isn't. Right? What might just be a fluke that's happening now or for a few years but ends up deviating. But the idea that as a Jewish collective, we're making active contributions to the real Torah, it's a real sort of unconscious prophetic experience we're having, that we're able to make a contribution to this broad corpus we call Torah, I think is an incredibly powerful corrective to that conservative impulse, right? The goal is, in some sense, to be just like earlier generations, but by inevitably adapting Minhagim, we end up being much more dynamic, and the Judaism that we experience ends up being fresh, was the word he used. A Minhag is not always the direct result of legal regulations. In the Minhag, the power of religious intuition operates as an autonomous self-legislation. It's not legislation that was passed down to us. We, in developing Minhag, are developing, and whether we're choosing to do it or not, we're all part of how our communities are developing Minhag, consciously or unconsciously. And we're all sort of self-legislating how our lives should be lived in that way. While the direct divine spirit, which inspires the prophets, may have been lost, the native talent of the people has not died and asserts itself in the Minhag. The older a Minhag and the closer in time to genuine prophecy, the more significant it is as a sign of the same religious genius. So, pushing back a little bit, he walks back and says, okay, but we should also know that a Minhag developed now is not necessarily as pristine as a Minhag developed back then, but what's important is he still thinks that Minhag is contemporary, that as Minhag is developed in later generations, it's still part of that same creative prophetic moment. And so Minhag is part of our way of preserving the Torah, on the one hand, but it also has a role in being able to creatively and actively engage in that same Torah. I think that's a really inspiring way for me to think about Minhag, especially as it relates to my own Minhag and my experience in my community.
About what Rav Soloveitchik said,
sure.
How they got to that Minhag.
Sure.
I assume that doesn't apply to like a community that happens to take on something that might actually be against the Torah.
Yeah.
The Torah is the overall more than the community.
Right. So what Professor Kalir, or Dr. Kalir, rather, in this essay deals with is a little bit this idea of, you know, balancing halacha and minhag, which is a major topic. If you ever heard the phrase a minhag tot or a minhag shtut, you have this phrase that some minhagim are, for lack of a better term, dumb. Like some of them are wrong. And how to balance a communal practice that seems to deviate from what halacha should be saying is a complicated question. But I think fundamentally the answer is, of course. Right, to choose an example from Nevi'im, right? So there are times in Navi where the vast majority of the Jews in Israel are serving idols. Oh, so now that's the Minhag and we should all serve idols. No, obviously not, right? But there's a certain range of which maybe Minhag will help us choose which interpretation of Halakha to follow. Maybe it will force us to a slightly different interpretation of a passage in order to fit the Minhag. But it definitely wouldn't push back against, like, you know, a sort of flagrantly wrong practice. Yeah, that's definitely the case.
Two questions. Would the idea of, like, polygamy with the Sephardim as of, like, 50 years ago with, like, the big Tzadik's Baba Sali, would you consider that a minhag?
That was one of the controversies. I mean, so much of this has to do now with the modern state of Israel, where Ashkenazim and Sephardim are sort of inevitably marrying each other, participating in the same communities. So a major tension they had early in the state was, are we going to allow polygamy? Because, you know, half the country seems to think it's a great idea and is a long historic practice, and the other half thinks it's forbidden.
So it is it would be a minhag.
So it definitely falls on those ethnic lines that we're talking about. Minhag is a bit of a funny word, right? Because the Torah allows it. Then Ashkenazi communities adopted what's called Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, right? Rabbeinu Gershom established this sort of universal Ashkenazi accepted prohibition on it, and Sephardim just didn't. So, like, they didn't change or deviate from the Torah. You know, Ashkenazim were the ones who did that. But yes, I do think it would probably follow the same dynamics as other, you know, customary practices. I think that probably would be how it would be interpreted today. Okay. You have a second question?
Yeah, the second question is, like, it seems that the small minhagims, like, from, like, Afghanistan, very small communities kind of get swallowed up by the bigger ones. Is that, like, just a natural historical process, you think? Is there a tendency for, like, the Ashkenazim kind of to win out that battle?
So that's an interesting question. Even within Sephardim, by the way, you have the question of, is, you know, centralization happening among Sephardi communities?
Yeah.
That used to be every... Yeah, so this is a major tension between... within Sephardic authorities and then also in modern Israel with sort of this perceived sense in the Sephardi community that Ashkenazim have more, at least had, I don't know if it's still the case, like a more dominant authority in religious matters. It's hard to argue what, like, would it be a problem? Are these communities deviating from the Minhag, or are they moving to a new place where the Minhag is now to do something else, and they should follow that new Minhag? Right. I think, like I said earlier about America, I think Israel probably is sufficiently, like, multi-Minhagic, that it would be hard to say that, like, you move to Israel and you're automatically expected to do a new Minhag. I've seen some people argue that with regard to Kitniot, that they basically say Minhag Israel is to eat Kitniot, and so if you move to Israel, you're allowed to change and start eating Kitniot. I'm not really sure it's true. I think there's a lot of Ashkenazim in Israel who just don't eat for 8 days. but yeah, these contemporary applications are one of the really interesting ways this topic becomes much more dynamic, I think, than it might have been in the past. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording, but...